Namaste and good evening. When I was meditating up here this morning, I just had these thoughts about our relationship to the animals here on the property and what a metaphor they are for our internal experience. Now here are these ticks that are the size of a dot of an eye that can make us really ill, and we're supposed to be aware of them. Which is a setup for paranoia if there was ever anything. And then there's that strange howling stuff going on at night, you know, that just kicks off, like, what is going on over there, if you've been listening to that. And then, you know, the stink bugs, you know, this whole invitation. They're so like so many of our thoughts, you know. They're slow moving. They're just sitting there. They're pretty easy to catch, you know, and release, you know. And then there are like the sneaky thoughts that are just gonna like catch you by surprise, like those little beagles. I was eating at the picnic table, and I looked this way, and I looked back, and one of the beagles was eating my pasta. Then there are the animals, which are the total blows to the ego. One yogi was sharing this practice of getting very, very comfortable and really kind of connecting with nature. And then a squirrel bounding toward him, which completely freaked him out. Which, if you ever had that experience, it's really quite a shock. So there's all that. And then there's the metaphor of merrily walking along and then encountering a 1,400-pound bull. And you have that experience of just encountering something and you're like, go, 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 you know, andare. And it just stands there and just looks at you. So it's all a metaphor, I think, of our internal experience. I wanted to talk a little bit tonight about how exploring through the body is really our gateway to awareness, and to talk a little bit about what happens when we hold the body for a sustained period of time as our primary object of awareness. Eric has spoken so beautifully of how this body is the earth, and I was so struck by this poem, one of my favorite poems by Carl Sandburg, called Wilderness. There is a wolf in me, fangs pointed for tearing gashes, a red tongue for raw meat, and the hot lapping of blood. I keep this wolf because the wilderness gave it to me, and the wilderness will not let it go. There is a fox in me, a silver-gray fox. I sniff and guess. I pick things out of the wind and air. I nose in the dark night and take sleepers and eat them and hide their feathers. I circle and loop and double cross. There is a hog in me, a snout and a belly, a machinery for eating and grunting, a machinery for sleeping satisfied in the sun. I got this too from the wilderness, and the wilderness will not let it go. There is a fish in me. I know I came from the salt blue water gates. I scurried with shoals of herring. I blew water spouts with porpoises before the land was, before the water went down, before Noah, before the first chapter of Genesis. There is a baboon in me, clamoring clawed, dog-faced, yapping a galoot's hunger, hairy under the armpits. Here are the hawk-eyed, hankering men. Here are the blonde and blue-eyed women. Here they hide, curled asleep, waiting, ready to snarl and kill, ready to sing and give milk, waiting. I keep the baboon because the wilderness says so. There is an eagle in me and a mockingbird, and the eagle flies among the rocky mountains of my dreams and fights among the Sierra crags of what I want. And the mockingbird warbles in the early forenoon before the dew is gone. warbles in the underbrush of my Chattanoogas of hope, gushes over the blue Ozark foothills of my wishes, and I got the eagle and the mockingbird from the wilderness. Oh, I got a zoo. I got a menagerie inside my ribs, under my bony head, under my red valve heart. And I got something else. It is a man-child heart, a woman-child heart. It is a father and mother and lover. It came from God knows where. It is going to God knows where. For I am the keeper of the zoo. I say yes and no. I sing and kill for work. I am a pal of the world. I came from the wilderness. How much have you been feeling the animal of your body these last few days? As you sit there and gnaw your food three times a day, as you watch that clever fox of your mind figuring things out, endlessly circling, have you felt the wolf ready to attack or defend, instigated by memories or hallucinations of your future? This body is of the earth. And sometimes it can feel like it's almost independent of the mind. We get to watch it in these last days. We react to it. We respond to it. Sometimes we react with aversion, sometimes with intense grasping, sometimes with compassion, and sometimes with balance and equanimity. We watch the cycles of input and output through the body. We get these signals when it's time to move, these signals when it's time to rest. We watch the lustful urges as they arise. We watch the loving urges as they arise. And we get to see and experience how the brain functions in the body. This reptilian brain, it's all designed for comfort, about creating a space, about safety in our personal safety zone. I've been amazed at stories I've heard over the years of in this retreat where we're cultivating this kind and loving space, of people who report the murderous rage they feel when someone's cushion has moved an inch closer to theirs. In the ashram where I lived, there was a very celebrated moment where two sisters dressed in saris got into a fist fight over whose cushion would be closer to the guru. This is a reptilian brain. And then there's the mammalian brain, which sort of has this connection to our emotional connectedness of belonging, or the non-connectedness we feel when we feel separate. Have you felt the chemicals of your brain circulating through your body? It's this great story of two married neuroscientists. At the end of the day, when they come back from work, one asks the other, so how are you feeling? And she said, it's been a really, really tough day. My serotonin uptake feels really low, and my oxytocin levels are almost non-existent. But I went to yoga class, and I can feel a little bit of an upsurge of dopamine, so that's good. We're learning so much about how brain chemistry affects our experience. All part of this animal body. So perhaps over these last few days, you may begin to feel a little more settled, a little more here. On our opening morning, Eric gave these beautiful, simple instructions, simple and blunt and frank, about resting awareness in the body. Having a narrow focus, if you find that's helpful, or a broad focus. There's a range, and whatever our experience is, we come back to whatever it may be in the body, to the sensation of breath, to the touch points, to the sounds. Our practices, this entire retreat, are essentially the same. But we get to feel our way deeper into the process. Perhaps we get to sense more subtly into our embodied experience. We start to become more aware of what we were not aware of before. This body is the ground of our practice, the first foundation of our practice. We come back to the pure physicality of our experience, the direct experience of hearing, of touch, of sight, of smell, sound, to the consciousness or the awareness of hearing, touch, sight, smell, and sound, to the ways that we react or respond to hearing and touch and sight and smell and sound. We feel this play of chemicals running through the brain, the cortisone of fear, the oxytocin of well-being and an open heart, the dopamine of gratitude. The Buddha declared that within this body, any question you have about the origin of the universe can be answered in this body. How can that be? There's a really wonderful distinction, I find, between biography and biology. Biography is our story. It's understanding the causes and conditions that have created the behaviors that we carry into the world, and understanding how, when we can change our behaviors, we change the outcome. Very helpful to understand our biography, our story. Another realm is the realm of biology, of what it means to navigate through this life with this nervous system that we have been given. In the West, we have spent a lot of time focusing on our biography, understanding story, causes, conditions. And from the East, I noticed that there's less emphasis on the story, but more about developing the skill set of integrating whatever arises. While we can investigate stories and beliefs, we come always back to how we are in the nervous system, in the body. So the body reveals our relationship to the moment, and it opens doors to understanding the nature of reality. And this is what the Buddhist teachings promise. This simple act of coming home again and again, if we pay attention, will reveal everything we could possibly know. So we see how we get stuck. We see how we get pulled into the vortex of what's happening, or into the undertow of feeling. We see how we hold the moment. There's a story someone told me recently, a mother with three little girls and had their friends over. And over time, as you know, when you get a bunch of little girls playing together, the sound level gets up and more hysterical and crazy. And she found herself just at the point of exploding. But something inside her paused. And she remembered these practices and came back to the body and felt the heat at the back of her neck, the acid in her stomach, the shaking in her hands. And when she paused, she asked, "What do I need right now?" And first she thought, "These little girls need a timeout." But then she realized, "I need a timeout." And so she paused and stepped back. There's a miracle there. There's a real miracle in pausing, checking in with this body, sensing what it needs. And as she told the story, the kind of the heartbreaking part of this is that these girls were preparing a little gift for her, and they were so excited about putting it together. And it all just came back full circle. One thing you might notice as you begin to settle, as Joseph Goldstein describes them as NPMs, noticings per minute, that the noticings per minute tend to go up a little bit. We tend to become more aware of what is happening. And when I start to pay attention to how I'm paying attention, I'm appalled at how often I'm away. And here's a little something I just ran across from Thoreau as he was describing his experience with mindful walking. It's, I think, from his journal. He says, "I'm alarmed when it happens that I have walked a mile into the woods bodily without getting there in spirit. The thought of some work will run in my head, and I am not where my body is. I am out of my senses. In my walks, I need to return to my senses." So we are not alone in this practice. So you might, in this moment, if you like, just for a moment, close the eyes and just sense your experience in this body. How do you feel the breath? When you open your awareness to the sense door of sound, can you feel the sound in your nervous system? Acknowledging smell and taste, the sense of the light beyond your closed eyes. And sensing for a moment how you are holding this moment in the senses. If you like, you can close the eyes or feel free to remain with them closed. My father was drafted as soon as he turned 18 and was immediately shipped to the front lines in World War II. He was wounded in Italy and wounded again in France. And as part of the invasion into Germany across the Rhine River, his boat with 25 men took a direct hit, and only he and one other man survived. When he came back to the United States, a year and a half later, and I just found this out about 6 months ago from his sister, who's 87 years old, that for months and months and months, he would wake up the household with his screaming. He's 85 and still working it out. We've learned a lot about how to work with trauma over those years. Back then, there was no vocabulary for it. There was just buck up and move on, which is what he did, and has lived a very, very full life. And now at 85, the trauma is so deeply centered, it's all he can talk about. Everything relates back to those experiences, and I can just sense how that trauma wants to be released. The body, the soma, wants to release it. And now there's so much work being done with returning vets of working with post-traumatic stress. And so much of the most successful work is the somatic work, working directly with the nervous system, strengthening the nervous system so it can process and integrate that trauma. As I've looked at trauma, it's very clear there is big trauma, and then there is all the rest of the trauma that we experience. And there is no one in this room that hasn't experienced the bitterness of betrayal or disappointment or shock. And as they say, your issues are in your tissues. All of that, all of those memories, all thoughts, all beliefs, all live in the body. How do we begin to unlock and unwind those places where we feel tight or congested or stagnant or not flowing? The trauma response results in three reactions. The reaction of fight, the instinctive desire to lash out. The reaction of flight, the instinctive desire to move away. And a common reaction, oftentimes overlooked, is freeze, where we simply feel that paralysis inside. If you've ever had a dream where you're being chased and you can't run fast enough or you can't move at all, it's that sense of being frozen inside. Part of the alchemy of transformation is to find some resource, some place inside where you feel safe. Tara talked yesterday about working with someone who found a resource or a refuge, imagining that she was with Tara and her sister and her therapist. That association created a sense of safety. In some somatic traditions, they have you look for a place where you don't feel the trauma, when you feel that overwhelm. And for some people, it's the tip of the nose. Other than the tip of the nose, there is that traumatic reaction. So part of our practice is to find that healing resource for ourselves. Where do we take refuge? And we'll be talking more about that this week. And there are all kinds of different practices and in different traditions about finding that resource inside, coming in contact with wherever the trauma is, wherever the unpleasant sensation is, different ways of gently moving into it, moving out of it, sensing pieces of it. All part of investigation, this whole investigative element of this practice. Oftentimes we might encounter sensation that is too strong. It may not feel safe to stay with it, in which case we can shift our attention to go for a walk or have a cup of tea. The question, the elemental question, which has been mentioned here before, but I find is so core to my own practice, is when we can open and sense the moment, however it is, to ask ourselves, how does this want me to be with it right now? When we can enter into that question, it sets up the possibility of intimacy. Sometimes we get a feeling from the body that it's not time to be with this, to set it aside. That question, how does this moment want me to be with it, allows us to open up the faculty of wisdom and clarity and compassion. Oftentimes when I sit with people with this question, the first response is, this wants me to make it go away. And it's always helpful to check back with that felt sense. The body doesn't lie. And oftentimes when you check back in with that felt sense, it may not resonate. Maybe what it needs, some people will say, is maybe just to give it a little more space, a little more attention. Maybe just to breathe and stay with it. This natural unwinding that is such an organic part of our practice requires that deep, caring investigation. It's only when we can bring that kindness, that generous, curious listening, and establish that sense of safety that this unwinding can begin and can mature in our practice. I find it helpful on retreat, all the different ways I can feel lost, all the different ways I can feel overwhelmed or underwhelmed by my experience, to remember that the practice is to come home to this body. When you are connected to the senses, you are truly here and now. This body does not live in the past or the future. So when we can listen to the present embodied experience, there is this potential for healing, a potential for balance, a potential for integration. And there's more. The Buddha promised that if you can rest your attention in the body, that every question you may have will be revealed. And the Buddha said that if you pay attention to the body, there are three fundamental characteristics of reality that will be revealed. And of course, what I love about the Buddha's teachings is he would frequently say, don't believe a word of what I'm telling you. Find out from your own practice. But these pointing out instructions can be very, very helpful. The first characteristic of reality we notice is that everything changes. This quality of anicca, of impermanence. Robert Frost said, in three words, I can sum up everything I have learned about life. It goes on. Our skin cells are replaced every 5 weeks to 3 months. The stomach lining is replaced every 5 days, with some cells being replaced every time there's digestion. The skeleton cellular structure is renewed every 3 months. Protein is renewed every 6 months. 98% of the total atoms are replaced in 1 year's time. And the whole body is comprised of totally new cells from 7 years ago. This body is in a constant state of flux and change and renewal. So what happens in our practice is we start to become more and more intimately aware of what changes. The more we relax, the more we pay attention, the more subtly and the more intimately we can feel that change. You might like just for a moment to scan through the senses. Once again, opening the doors of touch, of sight, of smell, taste, and sound. What in your experience, just for this next minute, is changing? Or another question, which one of my favorite teachers offers. In your experience right now, what doesn't change? Ram Dass tells a story. In the middle of the Sahara Desert, they found this ruin from prehistoric times, back when the Sahara Desert was filled with lush vegetation. It was a verdant land. And there was a stone with this inscription. And I don't remember the ruler's name, but the inscription said something like this: I am, and then the person's name, fear me, for you are in my kingdom. My rule is eternal, and I have dominion over this land. All these riches, all you see, are mine. What chutzpah. And how unbelievably wrong. But this sense of our dominion over nature is what has gotten us into so much trouble. The audacity of humankind to think that we have dominion over nature. Wayne Muller wrote a wonderful book called The Sabbath, talking about how important it is to pause, this ancient teaching of honoring the Sabbath as a time of rest. And he said, how outrageously arrogant that you would think the world can't do without you for one day. We fall into this false belief that this is not going to change. As one yogi once said, the greatest wonder in the world is that everyone dies. And the second greatest wonder in the world is that no one thinks they will. What I know of my great-grandparents is just about nothing. And in that same way, just a few generations from now, people will either have very murky memories of you, or you will simply evaporate into time. The good news is that when we shift our relationship to what is changing, we shift our identification with it. And the good news, as they say, shift happens. One of the wonderful things about this practice is, just like when you set a glass of muddy water on a countertop, over time, the sediment will fall to the bottom. That when we rest, when we pause, when we attend to this nervous system, when we nurture this body, there is a natural settling that happens. There is a natural clarity that begins to emerge. We can't make this settling happen, but we can allow it to happen. We are creating this container together for our wisdom and our compassion to emerge. It comes through silence. It comes through slowing down. It comes through cultivating patience. It comes through cultivating compassion. And in the interviews over these last days, I can sense that it's working. We're beginning to see the urgency that's driving our practice and beginning to soften just a bit. We're all starting to see into the conditioning, seeing what motivates us and where that motivation comes from fear and from greed and from confusion. We're starting to see the patterns into the nature of reality itself. So we're beginning to see that our relationship to what is or is not changing is whatever leads us to suffering or leads us to freedom. As far as I can tell, every religion on the planet splits into at least two factions, the Orthodox and the Reformed. There are those who say we have to update all this and make it relevant for this new culture. And there are those who say, no, we have to preserve the integrity of what we already have. Those who say we need to change and adapt. Those who say, no, we need to hold to the core principles. It's a natural schism that shows up everywhere. And we certainly see this in our culture now. We see our relationship to change. And as Eric said the other day, suffering is resistance. We're probably all familiar with that little mathematical Buddhist formula. P times R equals S. Pain times resistance equals suffering. So the question that we are living into is how we're holding this moment. In any given moment, we can ask ourselves, How am I holding this? Is there an element of grasping or clinging? Is there some quality, however subtle, of aversion or judgment or pushing away? Or is there simply a quality of confusion or not even being aware what we're aware of? Or is there a quality of balance, a quality of equanimity, this delicate, delicate flower of neither suppressing nor expressing, but just holding present what is here? The third Zen patriarch offered this advice. He said, be neither for nor against anything. To hold what you like against what you dislike is the disease of the mind. And we are all beginning to see that. The natural reaction of the mind to set up what we like against what we dislike. The more I focus on that, I can just see, for me it's sort of visual, I see a little meter. The 1 meter goes over to the green, which is like, or it goes over to the red, which is dislike. And in any given moment, that little meter is always moving. Oh, French toast moves over here. Oh, a long line moves over here. This constant reaction all the time to anything and everything. A built-in, baked-in neurological reaction to our moment. That reaction oftentimes shows up as resistance. And resistance manifests in so many different flavors. It shows up as all the flavors of aversion, judgment, comparison, ill will. It shows up as wanting to escape into fantasy or planning. It shows up as being on the hamster wheel of anxiety and worry and restlessness. It shows up as wanting to numb out, wanting to just fall into a sleepy swamp. Or it shows up as doubt, doubting our ability, doubting where we are, doubting our choices. Paying attention to that resistance. I think Eric said it was loving it, holding it close, and kissing it. And I found for myself that the degree of the intensity of my resistance, if I can stay on that wave of resistance, is equal to the degree of either the insight or the sense of release, the sense of feeling that felt shift of something tight being disbanded back into space. So the more we relax, the more we pay attention, the more we allow the natural phenomena to arise, to shift, to change all by itself, the more our sense of identity, the more our sense of identification can shift. We inevitably become more intimately aware of the content of here and now as it arises. But inevitably with time, maybe just for moments, we start to sense the field in which our experience happens. We begin to sense the space, the emptiness of what we're sensing inside. So the question becomes, what is this self? This third characteristic of reality, of anatta, of not self. When I thought about this, it reminded me of a story of someone who walked into a bookstore and asked the clerk, can you tell me where the self-help section is? And the clerk said, well, wouldn't that be defeating the purpose? I'll wait for that to roll out. When we turn our attention to self, what could this possibly be? Another story of two little fish swimming out to sea. The big fish is swimming the other way and says, nice water today, boys. And the little fish look at each other and say, what the heck is water? What is this self? It can be a real mind bender, literally. when we look at the sense of self, we automatically think of the character that we present out to the world. And it's important to have a healthy sense of self. When I moved to Albuquerque for a year after grad school, I went to a health food store. It was a really great place to hang out. And there are all these great pictures of a lot of the current Eastern teachers of that time. And I knew most of them. I looked around the room and it's like, well, there's Yogananda, Muktananda, Satchidananda, Sai Baba. And then this one picture that was right over the door into the kitchen, I didn't know who this guy was. And I kind of went around the room again, like, Muktananda, Yogananda, Satchidananda, Sai Baba. I just couldn't place this guy. Kind of had my meal, and I just went around again, Yogananda, Muktananda, Satchidananda, Sai Baba. And I looked over the doorway, and then walking through the door was the owner of the health food store, and that was his photo right there. And I thought, now that is a healthy sense of self. And as Ram Dass said, you got to be somebody before you can be nobody. Another classic story, which you may have heard, is in a temple a long time ago, the rabbi was talking about this whole sense of who are we? The sense of there's no self. We're nobody. We are the space in which all this is arising. And one man he got it. It was the president of the university, and he just ran up to the altar and he just ecstatically threw himself on the altar and he said, "I'm nobody. I'm nobody. I'm nobody." And it was such an incredible fervor that another man, he got it, and he stood up, and it was like the most famous surgeon in the city, and he ran up to the altar, and he was like, "I'm nobody, I'm nobody." And another man got it, and it was the custodian in the of the temple, and he ran up to the altar, he was like, "I'm nobody, I'm nobody." And the president of the university said to the surgeon, "So look who thinks he's nobody." Ego comes in so quickly. When we begin to even think about what is this sense of no self, one way to think of it is what it is not. A wonderful poem by Hafiz entitled, "How Does It Feel to Be a Man?" Once a young woman asked me, "How does it feel to be a man?" And I replied, "My dear, I am not so sure." Then she said, "Well, aren't you a man?" And this time I replied, "I view gender as a beautiful animal that people often take for a walk on a leash and might try to enter in some odd contest to win prizes." My dear, a better question for Hafiz would have been, "How does it feel to be a heart? For all I know is love, and I find my heart infinite and everywhere." I love that line. "I view gender as a beautiful animal that people often take for a walk on a leash and might try to enter in some odd contest to win a prize." What Hafiz suggests, I think, is in the absence of a self, there's something that's beyond the mind's capacity to judge or compare. In that absence, there is presence. And there's nothing but love. In any moment, we can ask ourselves, who is breathing? Who is feeling? How does this sense of self arise? The Buddha answers quite simply that the self arises when we regard the aggregates as "this is mine," "this I am," "this is myself." The aggregates are body, feeling, perceptions, formations, and consciousness. So self, in other words, is a projection of ownership onto all of our experience. This is my body. These are my feelings, my perceptions and formations. This is my consciousness. So the self is created. In the same text, the Buddha says that there is a practical way leading to the cessation of the view of self as a really existing entity, which is to regard the aggregates as, this is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. Andrew Olinsky, a wonderful Buddhist scholar, writes, why does such an apparently minor shift in perspective make such a huge difference? It turns out that so much of the harm we do to ourselves and others is triggered by this sense of ownership and identification. Reminded me once when I was in the Peace Corps in West Africa. I was off traveling for an extended period of time. And I came back and someone said, well, while you're away, someone broke into your house. They took your tape player. They took your music. They took your backpack, your books. They took your clothes. They even took your refrigerator and your stove. And I was kind of nonplussed. I said, well, you know, I can replace all of that. And then someone who lived right next to me said, well, they also stole your hiking boots. And immediately I went into this rage. You know, those bastards, my size 15 hiking boots. Finding size 15 hiking boots is a real challenge. And I immediately went to the marché, to the market, to see if I could find them and buy them back. And for the next number of weeks, I was so much suspicion, looked everywhere. And of course, they're all kind of little people in that part of the world. So there'd be these camel caravans coming in, you know, coming and going. I thought, maybe someone put them on their camel for extra traction. You know, it was, and I just saw so clearly that where the identification was, where the ownership was, the attachment was. The self attitude causes suffering. Non-self does not. It's as straightforward as that. And this is the pivotal insight of the Buddha, and it's meant to be investigated. The self attitude causes suffering. Non-self does not. We used to joke in the ashram because we had renunciate vows, and, you know, poverty vows. We used to always say, well, you know, no car, no car problems. No relationship, no relationship problems. And one of the best titles of a book by Anam Tupta is No Self, No Problem. So it all comes down to how we hold the moment. If you hang on, you get rope burn. If you let go, freedom. This is not a hypothetical theory sometime down the road. In any given moment, we can investigate how we are holding this moment. Not just how we're holding it in our mind, but how we're holding it in the body. And we can drop the awareness down to this embodied experience. Wonderful things can happen. So when we notice our moment in the body, our experience in any given moment, we can see into the very nature of reality. We can see in a visceral, practical way how everything is changing. Everything is changing. And we can see how our suffering, our stress, arises in our relationship to that which is changing. Anything we hold on to, anything we try to push away before its time, will lead to some quality of deep unsatisfactoriness. And we get to see how we identify with our experience. We see how anything we own as ours will again have some quality of dissatisfaction. Anything we can release, anything we can allow for a beautiful sense of possibility. One of my favorite poems is by Joyce Sutphen. It's called Living in the Body. And it really helps to reveal what we can realize. A body is something you need in order to stay on this planet, and you only get one. And no matter which one you get, it will not be satisfactory. It will not be beautiful enough. It will not be fast enough. It will not keep on for days at a time, but will pull you down into a sleepy swamp and demand apples and coffee and chocolate cake. A body is a thing you have to carry from one day into the next. Always the same eyebrows over the same eyes and the same skin when you look in the mirror. And the same creaky knee when you get up from the floor. And the same wrist under the watch band. The changes you can make are small and costly. Better to leave it as it is. A body is the thing that you have to leave eventually. You know that because you have seen others do it. Others who are once like you, living inside their pile of bones and flesh, smiling at you, loving you, leaning in the doorway, talking to you for hours, and then one day they are gone. No forwarding address. So I'd like to close with a meditation. An element of this practice is to intimately contact the form of here and now. At the same time, to embrace the space in which form arises and passes away. And you might, in these minutes, notice what is happening by itself. Breathing is happening. Thoughts are happening. Sounds are happening. And as we'll close with the reflection on sound with the bamboo flute, you might inquire into listening with the body. Opening to the vibration of all the sounds around you, as well as the vibration of silence. sensing the intimacy of form. Sensing the vastness of space. Namaste. Thank you for your most kind listening.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.